Wisconsin is bordered by two Great Lakes and the Mississippi, and we have thousands of inland lakes and rivers. So you think about it, water quality is a pretty big deal around here. Larry Mueller here again. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Our guests are from the Center for Limnology, and they're going to tell us about a new tool that they're using to monitor water quality. Emily Stanley is one of our guests. She's a professor in the Center for Limnology and the Department of Zoology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And Emily, great to have you with us.
Thanks to be here on this lovely day.
Yeah, Logan is a PhD student in the Freshwater and Marine Sciences program and is also a U.S. Geological Survey hydrological research technician. And Luke, great to have you with us as well.
Pleasure to be here, Larry.
We'll be talking about their work. They've done some really cool work on water quality issues, and you may have noticed maybe a change in the water quality in a lake or river in your area. Maybe you volunteered to help monitor various bodies of water. I hope you'll join in our conversation. Maybe I just have questions about water quality. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show, and we'd certainly love to hear from you. Emily Stanley, maybe we can talk first about the Center for Limnology, because I think it's a pretty cool place. Tell us about that center.
Sure, absolutely. So the first thing I want to say is I think when I first got here to Wisconsin, I was told by one of my colleagues that limnology is a word that everybody in Wisconsin should know. And so limnology is the study of inland waters, and what I like to tell people, it's like oceanography, except for lakes and rivers and streams. So the Center for Limnology is unusual in that it really is the only one that exists, and it's right here in Madison. The center itself started around, the building was right on the shores of Lake Mendota. For anyone who's been on campus, it's very distinct. It's the structure at the end of the lakeshore path.
Yeah, and pretty cool.
Yep, next to the Huffer's boats. We say it's that cement-like bunker. but it was built by Art Hassler, who was a very legendary limnologist himself. And then it's the center, sort of as a formal center, was started by John Magnuson, who is now retired but still an active limnologist. And, you know, the idea is that we have faculty from the Department of Zoology were in the building to have a very collaborative environment, and our postdocs and graduate students like Luke here and our research staff, where we can really take advantage of the unbelievable wealth of inland waters in Wisconsin. And, you know, University of Wisconsin has been the leading center for limnology in North America, and I would say the world, dating back to Burgeon Jude.
Well, I've talked to both those guys that you mentioned and over the years back now, but I always enjoyed talking with both of them, frankly. They're
gentlemen and scholars, for sure.
For sure. Luke, how'd you get interested in this whole area?
I mean, growing up in Minnesota, we're always around lakes and streams. You just sort of get interested in what's around you. I did one work assignment in northern Alaska studying lakes and caught the ecology in lake bug, and I've been following it around ever since.
So a couple of people here who are really interested, and Mendota, Lake Mendota, it's such a fascinating body of water. I tell the story before. I was out fishing once with a good friend of mine, and we caught 13 species of fish in a day of fishing on Lake Mendota. So it's it's the most researched body of water probably in the world.
Well, we like to say it's the best studied water body of water.
Yeah, it's gone on for a long, long time. Well, talk about, you've got a sort of a new research tool out there for monitoring water quality. Tell us about that.
Well, I'll start, and then I'm going to quickly pass it over to Luke, because really he is 50% of the brains behind its inception, and I am not the other 50%. But so this is what happens when you get two bright people together with a little bit of free time. And why, you know, having these university opportunities to be creative researchers are so important. And the idea was really for Luke's and then a former graduate student of mine, John Crawford, who is now also working with USGS. who had been using what we call sort of SONs or automated sensors that mm-hmm. usually get put out in a lake or a stream. And we have, for example, the buoy on Lake Mendota yeah. that has some of these sensors. And it's great. It's super useful. You can find out what's going on in the center of the lake at almost any time. We have an app for it. It's good. But it tells you what's going on at one point of the lake. And John and Luke thought, that's probably not the best thing in the world. And so I think I'm going to pass over to Luke to say how they solved this challenge.
Yeah, it really started with thinking about when we go to one place in a stream or one place in a lake, how representative is this one spot? You know, you walk upstream a little ways, you see the water flows through a wetland, or it's in the sun, or it's in the shade. And we really are wondering how representative is that one spot in terms of the whole river or the whole lake. And so what we did essentially was take these sensors and plumb them into a boat. And so as we drive around our boat across the lake or across the river or stream, we can map the chemical or the water below us. So now instead of just having that one place, we can ask questions. How different is the water in this part of the river? How different is the shoreline of the lake versus the middle of the lake? And really tackle some of these more lake-wide or river-wide questions.
So how's the talk a little bit about how this is constructed, because I think that's kind of interesting in and of itself.
Yeah, it's a it's a mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, plumbing problem that we've lost the first version of it to the bottom of the lake. We're slowly been improving our plumbing technique. So we essentially have a series of pumps and switches, and we have a pipe that we mount onto the back of our boat. So water is continuously pumped on board. It goes across all of these sensors that typically get fixed to things like buoys, and then the water is shot out the back of the boat. So we just have this continual loop of lake water or stream water coming on board. It's measured, and then it's ejected from the boat as we move around.
I was I remember in the first place, I remember watching a video of the buoy that the Department of College of Engineering put together a couple years back now. And so I was kind of intrigued by the whole, I mean, you're using PVC pipe, and it's sort of a kind of a Rube Goldberg looking kind of contraption that you put together.
Well, it started that way, I'll say. These guys spent a lot of quality time at Ace Hardware and Menards and things like that. And as Luke said, there are pieces of PVC that were separated from the structure and things like that. But they've really done a remarkable job at making this thing much less Rube Goldberg-like. And in fact, right now, the next step is trying to develop the technology. We've partnered with actual engineers from the physical sciences lab.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the group that usually does things like detect neutrinos for physicists and build equipment for that. And this is their diversity project to be able to get outside and work with lakes. But it really, it's quite an accomplishment what these guys, Luke and John, and then another graduate student of mine, Paul Schramm, have been able to build through just common sense and trial and error.
Yeah, it's a really cool, the whole process, I think. Yeah, and there's a great story. You spent a lot of time on the Mississippi, if I'm not mistaken. Tell a little bit about that.
Yeah, so in 2015, in August, we decided to take our we call this device the Flame. We took our boat with a bunch of sensors from St. Paul, Minnesota, down the Mississippi River all the way to Kentucky. We did this over a two-week period in the middle of the summer, mapping water quality, water chemistry, sampling different barbecue joints along the way, all the way down the river. And what we gain from this is a big picture view of the river. And so we can see, where are there interesting features? How do these different rivers flowing into the Mississippi affect water quality? And also, are there interesting places that are acting as biogeochemical reactors, so places where the water is changing a lot in a relatively short amount of space. And so that's what we did. We decided to map the whole river, and we're working on publishing the papers right now.
Yeah, there's a photo that I think Jill Nadeau, our producer, has already posted up on our Facebook page that shows the the entire Mississippi River in terms of its nitrate levels. That was one of the things that you were looking for, right?
Correct. So nitrogen loading to the Mississippi River is a big problem regionally. We have a lot of, you know, farm fields and agriculture, and we add fertilizer to the landscape. It washes into the river, and now we have really high nitrogen levels across the upper Midwest and along the whole Mississippi. Mm-hmm. So part of the goal of this project was to see where does the nitrogen come from and where is it going. So are there spots in the river that are really being our saviors, mm-hmm, and sort of cleaning up the river?
Well, I tell you what, it's fascinating to look at that diagram or that photo of that map that shows the levels of nitrate, for example, change significantly from sometimes from 1 mile to the next, and that's something we're going to talk about. We need to take a look at the news here, and we'll be back and talk some more about nitrate levels and talk about water quality and testing for it with our two guests, Emily Stanley and Luke Loken. And you can join in. Give a call, 1-800-642-1234. Back after the news. Our lakes and rivers are obviously very important to us here in the state of Wisconsin, and research is constantly taking place to keep to monitor those waters and hopefully to keep our ecosystems as healthy as possible. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Our guests with me in the studio today, Emily Stanley. Emily's a professor in the Center for Limnology in the Department of Zoology at UW-Madison. Luke Loken, PhD student in the Freshwater and Marine Sciences Program. He's also a U.S. Geological Survey hydrological research technician, talking with them today about the research that they're doing on our waters, our lakes and rivers, and I hope you'll join in. You may have some questions, maybe about the Center for Limnology, maybe about waters that that you frequent. I hope you'll join in the conversation. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. And Luke got a process going that they call, well, along with some other people, that they're calling flaming, which is a way to measure stretches of water or different parts, either of a river or maybe different parts of a lake, for the quality of those waters, and they can test on a variety of things. And so that's what we're talking about with them. We were visiting about the Mississippi, and I think we'll get back to that as well. Again, join in, 1-800-642-1234. And so the advantages, Luke, of this are the ability to monitor. Well, tell us again about the advantages of it.
Yeah, so one thing that our study or our system can help with is sort of understanding how different the water is here versus it is over there. You might imagine if you have one sensor and you have it in one place in a river, you might be missing a lot of what's going on upstream, downstream, or on the other side of the lake. So we're able to sort of see what the conditions are where people might be located. You can imagine a buoy in the middle of the lake doesn't see what the shoreline sees, but most people interact with the lake on the shoreline, so we might be better off sort of inferring what the lake looks like near the beach versus out in the middle of the lake.
Do you have you tried this on various waters or the same water at different times of the year?
Yeah, actually, this past summer, if anyone's out on Lake Mendota, you might have seen our boat motoring around all summer. We've been mapping Lake Mendota weekly throughout the entire open ice period. I think our last sample event was a week or two ago, so we're trying to capture that spatial pattern of the lake throughout the whole season. So we can see, does this side of the lake always have higher values, if it's algae, if it's pH or temperature, versus the other parts of the lake?
Well, as somebody who's done a lot of ice fishing over the years, the water looks so different in, you know, once you've got a layer of ice on it. And I would imagine it changes a lot just from ice breakup to that first ice. Wouldn't you say, Emily?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think in general, one of the things that really surprised me and probably surprised a lot of limnologists is just how variable the water is on a given day. And just, you know, being able to develop these maps and see that, you know, the nitrogen in one side of Mendota is very different than the other. The algal biomass is really different. And there's always been this assumption that lakes are well-mixed environments and that they're pretty constant in terms of what the water quality is from one place to the other. And this flame mapping has just completely blown that out of the water. That is not the case. There really are these hotspot locations, these places where some beaches are not so good. And others are great. Being able to identify point sources, like one of the early things that these guys showed was this huge leaking in of salt that turned out to be melting from the snow pile from parking lots.
Wow.
And then another thing that has been these guys added on this summer with collaboration with a graduate student actually from Vienna was being able to detect activity of E. coli, which are the bacteria that have shut down beaches. So now there's a fast way to go and try to find if there are places where there's a potential bacterial problem. And those are not evenly distributed either.
I was thinking about this as somebody who fishes a little bit. There might be ways to pinpoint areas, Luke, where the fishing might be better.
Well, yeah, you can imagine some of the variables that we can measure reflect the local part of the lake. You can imagine if you have a lot of macrophytes or aquatic plants growing in your lake, that might be where the fish like to hang out. But they also imprint the water. You know, they have they're respiring, they're giving off oxygen, they're taking in CO2, so they're interacting with the water more than just interacting with the fish or the other organisms in the lake as well.
Yeah, pretty cool. Let's go to Bob in Oconomowoc. Bob, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good. Hello. Thank you very much. My question, driving, and I heard you commenting on the Upper Mississippi River, and I'm wondering what you can tell me about the health of Pool 9, which is between the dam at Genoa and the dam at Linksville. Mm-hmm. And I'll hang up and listen to the radio.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Luke, can you pull that out of your memory?
Yeah, I'm actually working on that right now. So for those that don't know, pools are what we refer to on the Mississippi River as the area between two dams. So there are 26 dams along the Upper Mississippi River, and we think of each sort of area as a pool. And so Pool 9 is in southern Wisconsin, kind of close to Iowa, Illinois, Wisconsin. And this stretch of river basically from Lake Pepin or near Red Wing, Minnesota, down to Dubuque is probably the cleanest part of the river. What we found was that Lake Pepin is a big kidney in the upper part of the river. So it filters out a lot of sediments, a lot of nutrients, and that water quality really stays high until you get further south where you have other rivers coming in that might pollute the river.
So, and, you know, our caller might want to go to our Facebook page and take a look at that diagram, which will show nitrate levels as an example. And are there other places where people can go to look at your work?
We're working on publishing the data. We're still working on the papers right now, so we haven't released everything fully. But in time, all of our data will be available through the LTER server, which is what Emily runs here on campus.
Right. All the data will be publicly available and downloadable. And we do have had some paper. There is one Mississippi River paper that has come out. It's not about – or two, excuse me, two papers. One, but they are more focused on – gases that come off the lake. So these are things like carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide. And those papers, if anyone is very interested in sort of geophysical type things and gas exchange, I would be happy to point them in the direction of those two articles that Luke was involved in, as was John Crawford.
Excellent. Let's go to Mike in Castle Rock next. Hi, Mike.
Good afternoon. Who's looking at the streams that flow into the rivers?
Another good question.
Do you mean just across the state?
Well, I live in an area here. The streams here are in Castle Rock are spring fed, and there's plenty of data to in the summer they're biohazards with the bacteria from the farm animals, and there's plenty of data. Nitrate levels are high here, and I don't see anybody. There's plenty of data available, but I don't see anybody doing anything.
Yeah, this is a challenge. I'm not sure I have a very satisfying answer for you. You're right. I have actually sampled some of those streams in that part of the state, and you are not lacking for nutrients. And they're pretty remarkable. The problem is that nitrogen is not regulated, a regulated water quality variable in this state, despite concerns about its impact on streams and its potential health impacts at very high concentrations. But it is not something that the DNR is required to do something about unless it is a drinking water source. And that, unfortunately, is why those streams have a lot of nitrate in them. They are actually moderate with respect to their phosphorus concentration because of all the groundwater that comes into them, and groundwater tends to be low in phosphorus. So it's rough. I think the change will be as Castle Rock and Pettenwell have become eutrophic, people are beginning to pay a little bit more attention to that neck of the woods and the streams that feed into it. But, you know, right now it's sort of caught in a regulatory no man's land.
Yeah. Thanks for calling, Mike. Appreciate it. I know, and it's something that I guess you need to be visiting with your own representatives about.
That's great advice.
If you want to, Mike, be a thorn or a squeaky wheel, that's probably the place to do it. Tom and Nina up next. Tom, hello.
Hi.
Thank you for calling.
Okay. This is somewhat related to the last call. As you know, our regulatory agencies either don't have authority or they're being defunded, so they can't go out and do the sampling. So citizen scientists are developing means by which we go out and do the sampling. Okay. How can the data that we develop be integrated with data that the university, now you're talking about your sampling programs, how can those data sets and methods be integrated so that they're meaningful and we can include those in reporting on our aquatic environment across the state?
Yeah, good question.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think we are, as scientists, just beginning to figure out how to really tap into to what is really awesome resource of citizen science here. I can give you one example of how we have started to try to bring in the hard work and information that you guys collect. Is that Luke had mentioned LTER, and this stands for Long-Term Ecological Research. It's a project that's been going on through the Center for Limnology since 1980, and we provide a lot of information about a set of lakes. There are just seven of them, and we wanted to expand our view. So we've been trying to coordinate presenting some citizen science data. We've been looking at lake levels and trying to make links to also water clarity measurements. The water clarity of lakes is a really simple, straightforward thing that's a very potent way to get a handle on how lake water quality is. And I think we are trying to work with the DNR citizen science coordinator, because this really is the way to get stuff done in the face of finite resources. So hopefully over the next 5 years, you're going to see more growth in that area. We'll probably emphasize lakes more because that's our area of expertise, but I do know there's an active stream community of citizen science monitoring, and the best opportunity for those are watershed groups, like the Upper Sugar River Group, the Rock River Coalition, things like that have become very active and really good at using the data. And for the Rock River, there's a guy who's invented his own sort of version of the flame that he puts on kayaks to monitor water quality there. So I hope you have a watershed group in your area that you can get involved in.
Okay, we're putting them together. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Tom in Janesville up next. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Hey, listen, for over 20 years, I taught fishing in summer school to kids. And when I started, you know, I went through the turn of the century. That alone is an interesting thing to be able to say. The DNR put out a one-page list of lakes and streams in the state from which they recommend you do not eat the fish because of chemical contamination. And over the years that I taught fishing, it grew into a booklet. And so my question is, kind of like the last guy, with the current trends in customizing the DNR and pandering to corporations, is that improving or is that getting worse?
Go ahead, Luke. You can respond to that.
Yeah, so for a long time, we've been worried about mercury levels in fish. That's generally the the most important thing that we think about in terms of fish consumption here in the state. And there are new regulations, and as we get more data on how much mercury is in each type of fish and each water body, there's the DNR is sort of constantly updating those recommendations. In general, it's better to eat lower down on the food chain, so we do things like bluegills or panfish as opposed to muskies or walleyes or things higher up on the food chain. And I'd say I don't know if fish are getting healthier in terms of mercury. There's been a lot of environmental policy that's been implanted. I'm not sure how long it takes for that to fully go through the food web.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's getting better or worse either. I do know there is sort of one irony is that Wisconsin actually has been well above average in paying attention to the mercury problem. So one reason it seems like there are a lot of mercury advisories is exactly because people are making the measurements. So there's some other states where they have very few mercury advisories because they don't make any measurements. So on balance, I'd rather be here in Wisconsin where they're giving me a heads up.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Thanks, Tom, for calling. Dave in Reedstown, your turn now. Hi, Dave. Thank you for calling.
Hey, thanks. I'm wondering what good does it do to spend money on all this research when the laws are weak and the enforcement is weak. Case in point, Pepin State Park on the up by Trempealeau, beautiful park that I love to canoe and bike at, where the Trempealeau River comes in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I've been there once each or twice in the last 2 years. There are warning signs on the bubblers at the well in the campground for nitrates.
Yeah.
In May last year when I was there, there was hundreds of school children there, and some of the warnings were even torn off, so people are drinking that water. Now, I contacted Kathleen Vinehout, who is the state senator from that's District 32, I think, and she said that the DNR actually knows the major corporate farm that's polluting the water, and the DNR is working with them.
Well, what the main thank you for that, Dave. Appreciate the call, and I think the bigger question is, you know, what's the use of monitoring this if we're not, you know, if nothing gets done? But Luke, you probably have a comment for that.
Yeah, I would just say, you know, as we measure more and we see what the water looks like, and getting people involved and interested in the water, we're hoping that can sort of go into policy. You know, we're not going to go and say we need to clean up this place, but having more people like you knowing that the water quality is important, you can start to tell the right people, and if we get enough whistleblowers, maybe we can get some more regulatory action.
So and we're talking about unbiased research here that is doesn't have any political connections whatsoever. Sure.
Yep. No, we do try to provide information that informs policy, certainly, but it's not our mandate or to inform. In fact, Luke actually, as a USGS employee, has some very explicit restrictions on his ability to weigh in on federal policy because of conflict of interest issues.
Yeah, understand. Wendell and Marinette, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello there, Larry. I'd like to just mention some research that's going on at the UW-Marinette campus. This is where ongoing work by Dr. Renee Richer, who is a biologist on our campus. She has continued her work since coming to Marinette. Her work has been largely in Qatar, looking at some problems with cyanobacteria and neurodegenerative diseases. She's beginning to continue that work now in northeastern Wisconsin because there are several counties in our area that have elevated levels of ALS in its citizens. And I think maybe your guest today should know more about her. Perhaps they do, but their ongoing work is looking at a groundwater contamination by these algae infiltrating the groundwater, and of course the effects of the development in ponds of these what are sometimes called algal blooms. So mm-hmm. Renee Richer is her name. She's at the UW Marinette campus. One of her students just recently won a student paper award at a conference in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and they're doing some fascinating work, and it's always good to hear what's going on. And
yeah, well, thank you so much for that call. And Emily, are you familiar?
Yeah, in fact, I agree completely with everything you said. I mean, I think these blue-green blooms are a leading water quality issue that we need to come to terms with. We've tried to map out some hot spots and bloom development with this flame. And in fact, I have been in touch with Renee about potential collaboration for her, the unique and important work that she's doing and trying to provide a complement of mapping out where these blooms develop and why these blooms develop in lakes. But yeah, I agree. Her work is really interesting, and I'm looking forward to seeing where she goes with it.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling. Well, here we are starting to run out of time. Do you guys work with volunteers? I mean, we've talked a lot about volunteers here in the last bit, but
Sometimes we do, but not quite yet. I mean, in the context of the flame, we're still in this sort of developmental and very intensive research phase. But I think there we have had volunteers get involved with, for example, the citizen science projects and things like mm-hmm. that, and those are super useful. We have been talking about developing a Dane County water body survey for fall of 2017 that would be citizen science get involvement from volunteers. So perhaps something will be forthcoming next summer where we'll try to recruit some mm-hmm. folks and be in touch and see if we can get your help to get
sure.
folks lined
talk
up.
Talk about it, sure. Yeah. Well, thank you both so much for taking time to be with us today. It's a kind of this whole flaming business is pretty cool. By the way, it's an acronym for Fast Limnological Automated Measurements, or FLAME for short. Our guest today, Emily Stanley, professor in the Center for Limnology and the Department of Zoology at UW-Madison, Luke Logan, PhD student in the Freshwater and Marine Sciences Program, also the U.S. Geological Survey Hydrological Research. He works there as a technician as well. So great to have them along, and we'll kind of follow up on that citizen input that they may be seeking in the fall. So thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Rick Seeney joins us tomorrow, by the way, to talk about travel here on the Ideas Network.